Crokinole Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Hutchinson. In this podcast, I'll seek to provide an in-depth exploration of interesting and relevant topics in the competitive Crokinole world. In today's episode, I'll be joined by Ron Langell. First, we will get to know Ron a bit better, then Ron and I will tackle questions from the mailbag, and then we will briefly review the US Open tournament. Finally, I will look at the NCAA standings heading into the NCAA Tour finale at the Ontario Singles Crokinole Championships. But first, here's my interview with Ron Langell. Today I am joined with Ron Langell, and we are going to go through the mailbag questions. But before we do, I would love to hear and learn a little bit about Ron and his Crokinole career. So, Ron, share with everybody how you first got into Crokinole.
Okay, nice to be here, first of all.
Thank you.
I remember playing as a kid, being on the carpet, laying down, playing Crokinole around the age of 12, 14. That's all the memory I have of the early times. And then, I don't know what happened to Crokinole board. It must have just disappeared. I got a call in 2018 from my brother. He said, hey, they've got a Crokinole championship going on in Tavistock, and they have a recreational division. So I bought a board a couple months before the tournament so we could practice on it. We met at some place on the 401, one of those food joints, and played a little Crokinole, and that was our practice for the Worlds. And from then on at the Worlds, I saw the advertisements for the Waterloo Club. And through the Waterloo Club, I saw the advertisement for the St. Jacob Club and been playing ever since.
So you had literally hadn't been playing for decades.
40-something years, yeah.
And then and then you just find out about the Worlds and you decide to play. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I'm actually lucky my brother was the one that pushed it. He said, I'm going regardless if you're so... I just kind of jumped on board, so I'm happy that happened.
And how did you do that first championships?
As a team, we didn't do very well at all. I think our first two open our first two 20s were 20s the other teams made for us. I did pretty well in singles. I ended up third.
Nice.
In the singles, and which gave me a little bit of. Wanting to play some more and find out what the club was about.
Yeah, that's really impressive to do that well in rec singles after basically not playing for most of your life, right?
Yeah, it just seemed to come back. Like, it's funny because I was laying down on a carpet before and now I'm on a table.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seemed pretty natural to do.
Did you find, like, a lot of the rules that people usually play at home or learn as a kid or play at their cottage are kind of different. Were you surprised by the tournament rules that we played with?
Or? Oh, I went through all the rules online
a
number of times, so I knew what was going on. Even went through the scoring. We had no idea what the scoring was about.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, if there was a disc in the center hole, it stayed there and you... knock the hell out of it. Discs were flying everywhere.
Yeah.
So I was kind of prepared for it.
Okay. Yeah. You started playing competitively in 2018. What are some of your highlights of your Crokinole career?
Well, I would say this year winning my first NCAA event with Josh as a partner, Nolan Sound.
The doubles at Owen Sound, yeah?
Yeah. That would probably be the top one. There were times of playing some good player I had never beaten before where I did well. The first time I made the A group was my first year in the whole NCAA tour when we played in St. Jacob's singles. Mm. And I think I was the... cut off
the
line.
The anchor, likely.
Of the A group, and yeah. I probably ended up at the bottom of the A group, but just making the A group I thought was pretty good. I was still playing recreational that year.
Yeah.
So I did win the recreational overall title that year, so at the time that was a big deal for me.
Right. So you have a recreational tour championship.
Yeah.
And I know you won the U.S. Open in 2022 before it was an NCAA event, but you won that with Jeremy Tracy.
That should have been another one of my highlights I listed, yeah.
Yeah. And then I think you won a... I have it on crokinolereference.com. Check it out, everybody.
I won a few in the rec division.
You won a London rec singles, looks like.
That was the tournament that solidified my winning the overall, because that was the last recreational tournament that year. And I won a doubles with John Lichty
and Owen Sound, yeah. And kind of came second a month earlier at the Ontario Doubles again with John Lichty.
That was my very first tournament, that one.
Yeah, so you played with a number of different partners.
Yeah. So started with John, and that was at Bob Jones' suggestion because John had been away for a while.
Yeah.
And then just when John told me he had kind of had enough of the tournament lifestyle, Peter called me up and he decided he was going from recreational to competitive. I already knew I was going to competitive because I had won the rec, so what's the use of staying a rec? So, yeah, so we teamed up. And then I managed to win with Jeremy. That was just a one-time shot. And Josh and I have done pretty well.
Yeah, you and Josh are a formidable team. We had a really great showing in the Ontario or in Owen Sound, and then also had a great run in the Ontario Doubles the following month. So it'll be interesting to see how far this tandem goes and what success lies ahead. With that being said, I guess my last question to get to know you better is what's your next Crokinole goal? What are you hoping for?
Well, one is win something at the Worlds. I
think anybody could, door prize or
that would be good. That would be a start. But I think with Josh as a partner, and you get to the point where anybody can beat anybody, and especially with the format where it's just the total of your games cumulative as opposed to playing best of nines or best 11s. You never know. We might have a chance there. And since I've won an NCAA event with doubles, I'd love to win an NCAA event as a singles player. That's a little harder to do, but it's on my bucket list.
Yeah, well, you've been close. Those are both very attainable goals. Obviously, the rest of us will do our best to prevent it from happening. The other thing I would say is I don't want to give the Pink Pod shirt jinx or anything, but you're one night away from adding your name to a prestigious list of winners at the St. Jacobs Club.
Yes, yeah, I've been and it's funny, on the nights you do well, it just feels like whoever you have as your partner that game is doing real well as well. So, I think I've got a pretty good lead. I think I'd have to, like, break a leg or something to really wreck my chances. But, you never know. Someone gets 26 points and someone else gets 44 on the night. But, it's looking pretty good there.
Well, let's hope that you finish off strong on next Tuesday and take that home and add your name to that list. So, yeah. All right. So thanks for sharing a bit about yourself. We are going to jump into the mailbag questions.
Sounds good.
So I want to thank everybody for submitting their mailbag questions. I thought it would be fun to discuss it with Ron, as opposed to you just listening to me drone on about these. So thanks also to Ron for taking time to discuss these with me. So the first question is from Jason Malloy. He has two questions. The first is, what are your thoughts on fifth place trophies? I'm going to jump in on that one. I have to say, I appreciate fifth place trophies a lot more now than I did about a year ago. So I'm I have won a couple fifth place trophies, and it's not what I set out to win at tournaments, obviously. But it's great when I see individuals such as Jason Malloy and Mike Matag winning it instead of myself. So yeah, I'm really enjoying fifth place trophies at this point in time, but that could change in with the next tournament. Any thoughts on trophies like that? Gag trophies, joke trophies?
Yeah, I did find that a little bit ironic to see Irish Steel accepting the trophy this year. I think it's hilarious. I think it just it adds to the whole atmosphere of the U.S. Open and making it a fun, good time. I wouldn't have minded accepting that trophy of Seth running behind Usain Bolt at all. Yeah, I think it's great.
And Jason Malloy's second question, which I assume is a little bit more serious and potentially a little bit more useful for the general audience. His question is, which practice drill would you recommend above all others? So is there a specific drill that you will that you'll use to get ready for a tournament or to develop a specific skill?
I think a lot of people are probably expecting me to say open 20s. For some reason, I get bored open 20 shooting, and I question its value when I'm on the same board and you get into a groove. I like doing things like putting the discs in different positions compared to the 20 hole, positions where it's a shot that you should normally get, and practicing those ones. There's nothing worse than, here's a 20 I've got to get ahead, and you end up hitting the disc, say, dead on, instead of at the right angle to get it into the 20 hole. I do a lot of that. Mm. And then sometimes I just put discs in weird places and see if I can do a weird shot to get it, because you never know when you're going to get into a situation. I've had a situation where you have to go off a disc, hit a disc outside of the 15 hole and get back into the 15 hole. And I knew I could do that simply because I've been practicing it.
Right.
It's a hard shot. But
yeah.
At least you've got an idea what you're doing there.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess for me, kind of similarly, I used to practice just open 20s at times, but kind of echo the same reasons that for you, it's not necessarily, it's helpful in, I think, developing that muscle memory initially. But once you kind of got that down, it doesn't necessarily translate to the tournament experience, particularly well.
Agreed.
One thing I try to do and probably don't do enough is, after any tournament, like, I kind of have an idea of what were some of the shots that I struggled with, and then I'll try to kind of figure out, like, is it I'm just executing wrong, or am I actually, like, choosing the wrong exit path or the wrong angle or whatever on it or whatever. So that's something I like to, I've done some and should probably do more. There are some shots that I struggle with a bit, or some placements of discs that I have trouble with takeouts on that I should probably practice more. The other thing I do, and it's, people ask me and it's really boring, but my kind of go-to is I'll just play a game against myself, and I probably should do the thing where I switch side to side for each shot, because that's a good way to kind of slow down the game and really think about the best place to leave your shot and so on. Right. But I usually just stay on the same side. Yeah. Just for too lazy to go back and forth. I think that does a good job of kind of helping you see shots that you might face in a tournament, and it just kind of gets you warmed up for the tournament.
Right. Yeah, that was a good point about the type of shots. I was thinking I always do a few open 20s. The other one would be Hogan's Alley. Mm. Hogan's Alley is one where it's almost like if I don't hit it on the practices, I have to just kind of adjust myself a little bit and realize, like you say, maybe I'm not starting in the right place. I'm a little off on the angle. And it's just kind of like a reminder taking some of those practice shots.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jason, for those questions. The next question, and it's kind of related, is from Linder Wentz. He's heading up the Minnesota Crokinole Club, or Minneapolis Crokinole Club. I forget which one it's called. So if you are in anywhere of the great state of Minnesota, check that one out. So his question is, how much time do you spend playing or practicing Crokinole in a standard week? And do you know if that is significantly different from other top-level players? That is a great question. I'll let you start.
It is, and it's a very hard question because depending what's going on in the house, I don't necessarily have the Crokinole board out all the time. So sometimes if there's not a tournament coming up, I can go weeks without doing anything in the house. Now, we have the advantage of I go 1 week on a Thursday, I'm at the Waterloo Club. I go next week on a Tuesday, I'm at the St. Jacobs Club. So I don't really go that long without playing at all. When there's a tournament coming up, I'll bring the board out a week before, and a few nights in a row I'll be hitting it just so I feel like I'm really kind of in the groove.
Yeah. For me, I kind of have two answers. The first answer is before about last June, I would practice, or at least try to practice, about 2 to 3 times a week for maybe half an hour each time. And maybe right after a tournament, I'd take like a week off or whatever. But I was pretty good at consistently practicing. And since about last June, I have practiced very little to none before tournaments. Maybe the week before I'll take out the board and practice a couple times. And that's, not an intentional choice, just something with the rhythm of my life at this point. That's the current situation for me. And in terms of how it relates to other top level players, I don't think the top level players practice at home, like by themselves, that much. I know I've heard famously Justin Slater will not practice between tournaments. He'll just go from tournament to tournament, and often tournament win to tournament win.
Must be nice.
Yeah. And then obviously players play at clubs and stuff. I think from what I have heard, it seems like a lot of the top players, that's kind of their primary. It doesn't sound like a lot of players of the top players are practicing by themselves that much. And I think part of it is just the learning curve with anything. When you're starting out, like I would practice a lot by myself because a little bit of practice can produce a lot of improvements.
Right.
And the more you practice, the more improvements you see. But once you're at a certain level, it's like it takes a ton of practice to see like a very, very, very small amount of improvement. So I feel like a lot of the top players are kind of on that part of the curve where if I practiced 2 hours a week every week, or I practice no hours a week every week and then just practice a couple times before a tournament, then I don't necessarily see a huge difference in my results. So I'm guessing that's probably comparable for a lot of the top players.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say I feel a little worse about losing some of those 7-1, 8-0 games against you, knowing that you didn't practice at all, but so be it.
All right. So thanks, Linder, for that question. So next question was from Mark Longden. Sorry if I pronounced that wrong. He's asking basically about suggestions for a board. So a board which is good enough that I could eventually play in real tournaments but won't break the bank. So this is kind of a question that you see on Facebook Crokinole pages every once in a while. And it's kind of a desire. People want a good board, but may not have the disposable income at any given point to really get the top quality board. Right. And I've never really weighed in on these conversations online, but definitely there are people who will share their opinions. What are some of your thoughts on that?
I also avoid a lot of those. I mean, considering one of our friends is one of the top board makers, I think if I said something like, oh, go get a Tracy board, somebody would probably say, well, that's nice for him to say, he lives 10 minutes away from him or something. I think you have to get, for a starter, I mean, until you know you're really into the game, this is just my personal opinion. I started off with a board that some local guy had made. It was like a $99 board. I don't think you can get a $40, $50 board that's really going to play to the point where you know what you can really do. I jokingly said to somebody, if there's a checkers or a carom board on the back of the Crokinole board, it's not a real Crokinole board. They weren't serious about making a Crokinole board. So I think if you can get some in that lower range, around $100, low $100, and then once you find that, yeah, this is a game I really like, and it's a board that, by the way, if your children are playing, you're not worried about them wrecking, then you can go for one of those bigger boards. You know, the Brown Castles, the Tracys, the whatevers. That's my personal opinion, anyway.
Yeah, I've seen online a lot of people will say you're going to end up getting a Tracy board anyway, so may as well just get it from the beginning. I like that perspective, but also understand like that's not the reality for some people. And I guess in Ontario we're a bit lucky in that we can just kind of go to thrift stores. Right. Not that you'll see them there all the time, but if you're patient, you can just kind of like every time you're going by the MCC thrift store or whatever, just poke your head in, and eventually you'll see a pretty good, often homemade board or whatever, and it definitely won't play at like a tournament level, but it's definitely good to learn the game on. I found a couple that I purchased, and then like if I know of a family or a friend who's looking to get into it, I'll just give it to them or whatever. I guess I would say like definitely I wouldn't suggest buying a cheap board, like anything, like I wouldn't order off of Amazon. I wouldn't order off of Etsy or anything like that. Try to at least get like straight from a board maker or something. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a less expensive one. It's a hard question. It's a hard situation. But yeah, hopefully you can find something. And I think there is possibilities of like used Crokinole boards, so ones that have been used at a tournament or whatever can sometimes be sold for slightly less or whatever.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Hopefully that helps. Sorry that we didn't have a definitive answer for you, Mark. But those are a couple people thoughts. You can definitely kind of, if you post that on Facebook or social media, you will get more answers than you'd like. So, yeah. And next question is from Gina Schick from Shelburne, and a comes to a lot of the NCAA tournaments. She says, I overheard you, referring to me, tell someone at Owen Sound, quote, I'm used to the nerves, I like playing with them, or something to that effect. Can you talk about how you play good Crokinole in spite of the nerves? Do you have any tricks for settling down if they get out of hand. So I'll start on that one, and then I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on nerves. Yeah, for me, I find to a certain degree I do find that I play better with nerves. I find often in the when I make the semifinals, like I am very tense and nervous, and I tend to play a little bit better. And then if I win that and make it to the finals, usually I'm more relaxed because I'm like, well, this is my last game, win or lose. And then I tend to not play as well. So maybe it's just coincidence, or maybe it's because I'm a bit more loose. So it's hard to say. I think part of playing with nerves, for me, it's my goal is never to kind of eliminate the nerves. It's to kind of to coexist with the nerves. And so the more I play in nervous settings and important games, the more practice I get. That's a very vague answer, and I'm not sure how helpful that is. I would say, like, in terms of settling down, my thing is try to get all the thoughts about like what's going on in the game in my head. The worst thing for me is if I'm thinking like, oh, if my opponent misses this shot, then I should win this round or whatever. Because if they then make that shot, then I'm kind of, it's like I'm coming from a negative position. And I know if anybody has had a chance to read Joe Phillips' book on Crokinole, Brian Cook has a section in it that he wrote, and he talks a lot about the mental game. And he talks about, like, I'm sorry if I got this wrong, but from what I remember, he would like not look at his opponent when they're shooting, because he doesn't want to like be thinking, oh, miss, please miss. Because if they do, then he's heading into his shot with negative thoughts and negative feeling. Right. And so one trick I kind of tried to do, like when I'm in a 20s race, that it's a tensed 20s race, and it's like each 20 is more and more important, is I try to do some reverse psychology, and I'm like in my mind, I'm like, yes, I want my opponent to hit it so I can hit my next one, right? Like, right. And just so that I can come, like, if they do hit it, then I'm kind of coming from a positive, like, a spot of confidence. So I don't know if that works or anything. It's just a way I try to convince myself that I'm a good player in my mind. In my mind, I say, oh, like you're a great 20 shooter, or Andrew Hutchinson, you got this, whatever. And it sounds a bit arrogant when I say it out loud, but it's kind of a trick I do try to get myself in a positive mind frame when I take my shot. So yeah, any thoughts from you dealing with nerves?
I wish I could deal with them as well as you sound like you do. I've gone through some stages. I used to get nervous at every tournament until I was playing somebody I knew. So I don't know what the psychology behind that was. Maybe try not to look silly with people you don't know. And then I'd calm down once I hit somebody. I still get nervous at the beginning of tournaments. And I really don't have a magic formula. I can tell you, I just get to the point where at one point I realize I'm not nervous anymore. And when you get into the bigger games, it's kind of surprising. In bigger games, I managed to get more focused. So even the U.S. Open, you're at the final table. You know there's cameras on you. Everybody's circling you. For some reason in those, I find that you can get more focused, that even though you're aware of all that stuff happening peripherally, that you can concentrate on what's going on the board. And I think that kind of concentration pushes aside the nerves. Except there's a few shots sometimes I'm thinking, oh, I hope I can make this one because it's a big shot. But gosh, when I started, my hand used, like, my first time at the Worlds, I could literally see my hand shaking as I went to shoot. So I'm not that bad anymore. I wish I could control them a little more than I do.
That reminds me, my first NCAA win was 2018 Owen Sound. I defeated Ray Bearling in the finals, and my hand was shaking so much. And I was so, like, visibly tense and nervous. And I was shooting, like, lights out, like, really well. And there was a point in the match I was up, but it was like a kind of a swing round. If I won that round, I was going to be like one round away from winning the whole thing. And if I didn't, then he would be like closer to me. And I had a really important open 20 shot. And then what's going through my head was, if you hit the shot, you're going to win the tournament. If you don't, you're not going to win. And I hit the shot. And so that was a big relief to me that I could get over the hump, that I could win an NCAA tournament. I knew I could play well, but I didn't know if I could like deliver when it mattered in the final. And that was a big relief to me. And then fast forward 5 years from that, and I was playing Josh Carafello in the Ontario singles tournament in last May, and he's shaking, he's visibly nervous, and he's shooting really well, and I was like, he's playing like I was 5 years ago.
Right.
I'm at that point, I'm the experienced player, and he's the new player who hasn't won a NCAA tournament, but he is shooting lights out. And I was like, I don't know. I kind of saw a bit of my past in him, and I wasn't happy to lose because I really wanted to win that tournament, but I was happy for him and kind of knowing where he, like, having experienced that myself, it was nice to see him kind of to be able to overcome those nerves, play through those nerves, and play incredibly well. So.
Yeah, it's kind of like his coming out party there, that one.
Yeah. And you benefited a few months later
at On Sound. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah. All right. So the last question we have is from Daniel Marino. Sorry, Daniel, if I pronounce your last name wrong. So he is from Madrid, Spain. So I'm just going to read through. It's a bit of a longer kind of question with a couple parts. So he says, we are writing to you from Madrid, Spain, where we inaugurated, sorry about that, the first club dedicated 100% to Crokinole a year ago, the club 20x8. We have many questions for you. We want to promote it and would be great to have a set of guidelines from your end. We're realizing it's not an easy task, so any advice you could give us on the steps to take would be greatly appreciated. And directly we ask, what steps should we take to expand it? How can we introduce it in a country where it's unknown? Let me ask you, being Crokinole... Oh, actually, I'll stop there. We'll answer that. And then there's kind of a couple other questions that we'll jump into. So for this, I'm not sure how much I'll be able to help Daniel, because I haven't really had to kind of promote Crokinole from scratch. But any ideas in terms of... promoting Crokinole that might be helpful to also those who are starting from in a country that doesn't know Crokinole too much?
Mm. Well, first of all, it's great to hear that they're playing out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to build it up. I don't have much experience on the organizational side. I do find that if you're playing something kind of casual, that seems to be the focus lately is maybe they have a couple of boards at a bar, or you have some kind of agreement to go on there, usually on a weekday. Getting somewhere public where you've got the boards out and people are apt to go, oh, what's going on over there? And then they see and they say, well, that looks like it could be fun. And then as long as you're aware of who's around and you can invite them to sit down, you certainly don't want to get into something where you're in some big match with other people. The idea is to draw other people in and get them to sit down and try it out. And we've had that happen a number of times in Elmira. What was the name of that one place that has the tent outside in the back?
The Rural Roots Brewery.
Rural Roots, yeah. So we're in the back, and there's people there who had no plans at all of playing Crokinole, but they end up sitting down, and they end up coming out the next week, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Crokinole is a unique enough and like visually interesting enough game that just being in public playing it can draw in some sort of attention. Once you've got that, then it's kind of trying to get people from, oh, this is interesting, to, oh, this is something I want to show up to every 2 weeks or every month or whatever. It's kind of getting that commitment, which again is, like, honestly, I don't know. We'll have some player, like some individuals, come to a tournament, never been to a tournament before, play really well, like maybe even make the A group or do well in the B group or whatever, and then we don't see them again. It's like, I don't. And then there's some players who might not be that great, but will like keep on coming out. So I don't know what makes some people decide to keep on coming out, and some people like, oh, that was fun, but I'm not kind of committing my time to it. It's not a great answer, if an answer at all. I would encourage kind of, there's a lot of emerging clubs in the States. There's a lot of emerging clubs in Europe that I think probably would have better insights. Any other thoughts about that first part?
Well, I can think of the chess club I used to belong to, and once in a while we'd play some games out when it was nice out. We'd play some games out on the city tables they had out there. We'd have a little tournament going on instead of in a room outside in the main building type. If you can get somebody from the city to say, yeah, you can go here. The one time we went to the Waterloo Rec Center there, I went with Jeremy and a few other people, and we managed to get people watching and inviting them to sit down. I don't know if any of them ever end up coming back, but yeah, you've got to get people to try it and see what they think.
Yeah. The next question I find interesting. So it says, being Crokinole is the Canadian national tabletop game. How is it possible that you haven't received support from any multinational or national companies? Have you had any contacts? So that's interesting, because in Canada, although Crokinole is well known, I feel like it's such a
niche,
and then also kind of traditionally just a game that people tend to play with their friends and family at Christmas or at the cottage. Like, most people I know have heard of Crokinole, have played it, but are also really shocked that there is a National Crokinole Association, that there's a World Crokinole Championships, that I spend a whole Saturday basically every month going to a tournament. Some make fun of me for doing so. Despite its being well known and to some degree popular in Canada, it has never really seemed like it's something that larger or even small companies would want to sponsor. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I think that it is a niche market right now, and I remember Jason on one of his earlier podcasts, Jace Malloy.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, he was joking, saying he thought that every Canadian child that was born was given a Crokinole board. But I think you mentioned it with some of the recent changes in the NCA. I mean, there are pockets out east, and there's people playing in BC. So not to denigrate anybody who's playing in other areas, but let's be honest, the National Crokinole Association is strongly centered in southwestern Ontario.
Yeah.
Right? So It's I don't think it's as big of an across the country phenomenon as it might appear to be.
Yeah, I think the biggest possibility for any sort of sponsorship would be at the with the World Crokinole Championships, just because of the name, and it, I mean, yeah. it also gets out a large number of people, but it's the fact that it's in Tavistock, Ontario, maybe limits that a bit. But with that being said, like, it gets a lot of great local support from a lot of local businesses and so on. So it's good in. An event that big in a town that small will definitely get support from the surrounding community. And maybe that's better than, maybe it's good being a big fish in a little pond than the opposite. So, right. Yeah.
I think the other thing is the growth right now. I mean, we're talking about being a Canadian sport. The big growth I think we've seen has been in the States.
Yeah.
I mean, they have five just Extra Pint Crokinole clubs themselves. And Jeremy, it seems like every second or third week, he's off traveling to some event in the States. So it's certainly catching on there. I think it's a little more going across the map down there.
Yeah. And then the last question from Daniel is, again, it's kind of about boards and costs. Kind of asking about how to grow and grow with numbers of boards when boards are expensive. And I think this is more pressing in countries where you're going to have to import the boards, and so it's. In some ways, it's more of an economics answer than anything. So I know, yeah, I guess, like, if you're shipping from Canada, if you're getting boards from Canada or whatever, like, it's just going to be naturally expensive, not just the board, but you have to get the shipping costs in too. I think it's a positive that crokinole boards are handmade and not mass produced, but one of the negative impacts of that is if you're not living in a place where they are handmade, then yeah, the price is going to be higher when you include the shipping and then in some cases like import fees or whatever. So yeah, beyond maybe they're like them being or somebody deciding to build boards in that area. I'm not sure too much. I have seen, like, there's a board builder in England now that I've seen who kind of specializes in like good quality but not as expensive. So he's not his goal doesn't seem to be like the top end, but like still really, really good quality and producing at a lower price. I know there's board makers in Hungary and some other places in Europe. So yeah, I can't speak too much about to the prices of those, but the more places where their boards are being made by hand, then yeah, hopefully there's something that kind of meets everybody's need.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, because we have boards available from all kinds of sources. But I would say if you go online, I don't want to dissuade anybody from getting a top-notch board, but if economics is an issue, most places that sell a number of boards will have different price options. You get what you pay for, but if you want to get something started, maybe the trade-off is to get one of the lesser boards and maybe share the wealth where a few people, as opposed to a club trying to suddenly have eight boards available for everybody, maybe if a few different people each buy a board and your club for that while is everybody bring your own board on game night, right? Yeah. I'm pretty sure even the LaSalle Club, which is fairly new, but they seem to get 20, 24 people out every time they're out. I'm pretty sure they're on the basis right now of everybody, please bring a board if you have one. I don't think they've managed to get a stock of them right now, so that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, even in tournaments in Ontario that have been going on for 10 plus years, most of them still operate on the, like, register and let me know if you can bring a board. And it's, very few, like, the Worlds have owned their own boards. The Elmira Winter Crokinole Classic, it's one of the co-runners of that tournament is Jeremy, who is able to bring his own boards to it. But most tournaments, it's people are bringing their own boards, so right. It might be expensive for a club to purchase 4 to 8 of the most expensive boards, but if there are 4 to 8 people who are able to purchase a mid to high quality board and then bring it to clubs or events, then that's a way to kind of spread the load. And then in time, if your club charges fees, a couple dollars or a couple euros per person per club night or whatever, then you can kind of accumulate some money to purchase supplies in the future. It's a slower way to get there, but I know that's a way that a number of clubs are able to finance and purchase boards.
Yeah, I think the Waterloo Club used to do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for submitting those questions, and thanks Ron for working through those with me. I hope to do another mailbag episode in maybe a year or so. So thanks everybody for that. And finally, Ron and I are going to discuss the U.S. Open that just took place this past weekend. So Ron, what was your kind of initial impressions of the tournament? This is the third one that you've went to.
Right.
So how did this one compare as an event?
I think it seems to get better every time I go. Because obviously they learn stuff from previous times. It's an event. It is not your typical tournament. It's I heard Chet call it a destination event, and I think he's spot on. It's a lot of fun. It doesn't matter if you're one of the top teams, one of the teams there for the first time. Everybody's having fun. Everybody's enthusiastic about Crokinole. People are playing Crokinole after the tournament's over. You've played 12 hours of Crokinole and they go someplace else after and still playing. It's just a fantastic event. I would recommend anybody to try it out.
Yeah, it's a great event. I think it's made even better by the wide range of people who come. Skill-wise, experience-wise, geographically, it's a very diverse event in terms of different people coming from different areas, and it's great to see it really truly become a full-fledged U.S. Open where there's a team from Oregon, a team from Kansas City, team from South Carolina, North Carolina, Chicago, and and I'm missing out on so many other states,
Vermont,
New England, all over, in addition to Canada. So, it's a great event, and the keyword there is event. It's not just a tournament on the Saturday. Starts off with the social on Friday, and the whole Survivor, just so many. Different aspects to the weekend. So yeah. You finished second with your partner Paul Brubaker.
Right.
Take me through your personal experience and how you guys did, and share about your weekend competitively.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. I saw the draw, and my thoughts were we were in the toughest group, the loggers. There were a lot of good teams in there. And the fact that the loggers teams placed, I think it was first, second, fourth, and sixth, shows how good the teams were there.
Yeah.
So going into it, we placed fourth last year. And in my mindset, I would have been delighted if we had ended up fourth or fifth this year. Of course, you always want to do better. So we got through the morning better than I expected. There were a lot of tough teams, but we did okay. We ended up second in our group, fifth overall. So when you're in the higher tier there, your next few games, once they get to the afternoon, is a little bit easier than what's going to come up because you're playing teams that ranked a little less. And we got through that. Our biggest or our first challenge was playing Nolan and Reed.
Mm.
And I guess that would have been the quarterfinals.
Right, yeah.
It was a real back and forth. I'm interested because when you're in the middle of the game, you're so focused on what's going on right now, you might not see what the big picture was. So I'm almost interested to watch that game if they show it because there were cameras on it. It was really back and forth. The rounds were back and forth. The game, it was one of these 2-0, 2-2, 4-2.
Yeah.
So we managed to get through that. I think it ended up 10-6. At one point, it was 6-6.
Right. Yeah, I guess just to jump in, like despite Jay Malloy's lack of respect for Nolan and Reed, they are a very strong team and had a very strong showing. So, yeah, that would be a tough opponent and match to have in the quarterfinals, knowing if you get knocked out of, if you lose that one, you're out of the money, right?
You're playing for the vaunted fifth place trophy.
Exactly, yeah. So you survived that one, and yep. Then who did you play in the semifinals?
So then in the semifinals, we played the Holy City Flickers, which is Ben Harding and Joe. I don't remember Joe's last name. I think it's
Seifert or something like that, maybe?
I think it started with an F, but sorry, Joe, I don't but I really didn't know that much about them going into the tournament. I knew they were half decent when we played them in the morning. They were another team that was in our group. And they had knocked off Irish Steel.
Yeah.
So in my mind, boy, this team's really playing well. So we were fortunate enough to get through them. I think it ended up 10-4.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a race to 9, which I forgot about. So after it was 8-4, I went to congratulate everybody, and they said, "No, you still got to win another one." So we managed to win that. I think it's great that they ended up overall in fourth, and I think it was absolutely fantastic that the whole level of all the American teams seemed to have really taken us a step up.
Yeah.
There's definitely some teams in there that can be competitive anytime. And that took us to the final.
So the finals, you played the Bearlings.
Right.
Is this the first time you... Oh, no, because you played them in elimination with Josh at the Ontario Doubles.
Yeah.
So obviously the Bearlings are the... Arguably, if not obviously, the top doubles team... out there right now. So how was this experience playing? Like, were they kind of right at the top of their game?
Oh yeah, they were playing good. It's one of those things. I think the things that separates, if you think of the, I always think of the top two teams being the Bearlings and the Slaters.
Yeah,
and they're capable of making great shots when they need to, but they win games by, once they're ahead, they don't give you a chance to catch up.
Yeah.
It's all about board control and keeping your disc to the outside.
Yeah.
So I was happy. Paul and I were kind of laughing to each other before the game, kind of like just thinking we're in the final game. We weren't expecting us to be in the final game. So I was glad we made a half-decent showing anyway. I think we got 6 points. I think it ended up 12-6.
12-6, yeah.
Yeah, so it started off close, 1-2, nothing, 2-2. It got to 4-4, and then they started pulling away. So sometimes it's like you think you're in the round, and I think if I look back at it when they eventually show it on YouTube, I'll find that some of those rounds... we weren't in it as close as we thought.
Right.
It got near the end where some of the rounds, I'd see it slipping away, the round.
Yeah.
And I would try some shot that wouldn't normally be recommended to try, but it's one of these things like, I'm either going for this big hero triple takeout.
Yeah.
And if I fall flat in my face,
we were going to lose the round
anyway. They got 4 discs on the board. Yeah.
You got to do something.
We've got to do something. So we gave it our best fight. They were obviously the better team, and they were on. And there were a few times where it looked like we were in charge, and whether it was Ray or Jason making some great follow-through 20 or off the disc and into the 20 hole. I mean, that's why they're world champs a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, and... to your credit, especially throughout the game, but especially early, you were making a number of really big and impressive shots. A lot of takeout 20s, in off 20s. You had the crowd eating out of the palm of your hands with some of those shots.
I felt like I was really on.
Yeah.
Although I wasn't letting it get to me, You know, I was able to concentrate enough that, oh boy, look at me, I just made the shot kind of thing. It was, okay, I made the shot, nice.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens next. I don't know whether I cooled off a little bit after that or if it was just that their board control was...
Yeah.
It felt like their board control was so well that I didn't have a lot of opportunities later to make any... of those kind of shots.
Fair enough.
So, and Paul, I felt sorry for Paul, because I'd swear half of the open 20s he tried were going right over the hole. And I'd look at it and think, that didn't drop. And it would leave a hanger there. And of course, the Beerling's on a hanger. You might as well just give him the point.
Yeah.
Half the time. Yeah. So Paul played great all day.
Yeah, he's a good player.
Yeah.
Just touching on the Beerlings, we played them and lost them in the semifinal. And my experience playing against the Beerlings in doubles is I know by the end of the first round if they are going to be nearly impossible to beat or... like beatable, but you still have to play really well.
Right.
And I could tell, like, they were both on with their open 20s. They were both sharp with their all the other shots. And I knew after that first round, like, we would need to be nearly perfect to beat them. And we weren't. We played well, but they were kind of top form in that game and all day, it looked like. So yeah, all the credit to the Beerlings for another doubles victory to their resume. I want to kind of quickly go over some of the results, and then if you have any comments or observations from any of that. So as everybody knows, the Beerlings did win, and in second place was Ron and Paul. In third place, myself and Jeremy. And fourth place was the Holy City Flickers. So again, Ben and Joe from South Carolina. Fifth place, Irish Steel, Jay Malloy and Magic Mike Mittag. Congratulations on that trophy, gentlemen. And they beat out the Cheeky Buggers. So that's Mark Boot and Lord Mark Boot, and Simon Dowrick finished sixth. And the Nolan Nolan and Reed Tracy finished seventh. And I believe they beat the team from Chicago, which was Adam and Michael Barth. So I definitely agree with the statement that all the teams, and especially teams from the States, have improved a lot and are very strong play. Definitely true. The Canadian teams, I will point out, still were able to finish top three and the five of the top seven. So, just wanted to observe that. But yeah, definitely the American teams were very strong. Like, we did not have really, we had maybe a couple of easier games in the round robin, but like every match was a lot more challenging than in past years. So it's good to see that growth. Another team that I need to shout out is Travis Keener and Aaron Lewis. We defeated them in the quarterfinals, but it was incredibly tense. Every round was so close, and it was we were, I wouldn't say fortunate to get by them, but like they pushed us every round. They pushed us to the brink, and two very strong players who played well together.
Another point about that, just the U.S. Open overall. I heard back where we were staying, there were a number of us in one big house, and there were some people that were saying it's hard for them to get together because the next person they know might be an hour away. And from my perspective, part of what makes this a great event is we go around southwestern Ontario, and you're pretty well playing the same guys most of the mm-hmm. time, except unless there's some local people coming in. I get to play a lot of people that we don't get to play against normally. And I guess now that he's got people coming from six or seven states, they may feel the same way. You know, someone coming from Vermont or Illinois, and now they get to play people from all over the states. That gives it a little bit of extra flavor to me as well, playing people and meeting people that we don't normally see.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a great event. I can't stress that enough. And looking forward to the next year and see how many different teams from how many different states will be there next year. So yeah, any last observations or thoughts about that event?
No, just that I can't say enough about how fun it was, and anybody wants to have a good time, be on the lookout for signing up for that one for next year.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so again, congratulations to the Bearlings, and again, thanks to Jason Malloy and his whole team of organizers, the whole club, and he has a little committee there who organizes that event. So thanks to all of them, and wonderful event, and we'll see you next year. Ron, I just want to thank you for sharing a bit about your Crokinole journey and for working through some of those questions, and for your thoughts on the U.S. Open. And we'll talk to you later. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So we are heading into the Ontario Singles Crokinole Championship, which is the tour finale for the NCAA season this year. The winner is up for grabs. So there are two possible individuals who have a chance to win the tour, and that's Connor Reinman and Justin Slater.
the caveat is there is mathematically Ray Bearling is in the race, but he will not be attending that tournament. So in effect, he is has no chance on winning the tour. It is only fitting that it's coming down to Connor Reinman and Justin Slater. They have been battling back and forth all season long, and it's only fitting that they both have a chance heading in for the tour to heading into this last tournament. Connor Reinman has 197 points. He has 3 victories, and his next highest is a second. And then Justin Slater has 195 points. So 3 victories, and his next highest is a third place. So if either of them win it, this tournament, they'll win the tour. If Connor wins this tournament, he'll win the tour. And if Justin wins, he'll win the tour. And if neither of them win, then Justin still has a chance at winning the tour with a second place finish. That would bump him up to 197 points, which would place him in a tie. And then the tie break goes to whoever finished higher at the Ontario Singles Tournament. So there are a couple of pathways to victory for Justin Slater for the tour, but he at least needs to make the final and not have Connor win. For Connor, he just needs to either win or have Justin finish third or lower in order to secure the title. Another race that is a little bit interesting is Ray Bearling is in third with 192 points, and he is trailed by Andrew Hutchinson, myself, and Josh Carafello, who we're both tied for fourth. And so with a victory, myself or Josh could jump Ray Bearling for third place to make the podium, but it would require a victory. So it's considering the field that looks like will be there, it will be a tough job for either of us to do, but it's another interesting storyline after the race for first place. So besides the top five who I've mentioned, Connor in first, Justin, Ray Bearling, myself, and Josh Carafello tied for fourth, I'll just kind of go through the next few names in the NCAA standings. So in sixth place is Jason Bearling with 186 points. Just behind him in seventh is Ron Langell with 185 points. In eighth place is Jeremy Tracy with 176 points. In ninth is Nolan Tracy with 170. In 10th is Nathan Walsh with 167. And outside of the top 10, we've got Reed Tracy with 164, and Travis Keener with 154. I believe they'll be at the tournament too, so trying to jump their way into the top 10. So. Yeah, so it's been a great tour season, and it'll be interesting to see the results in the Ontario Singles. Just from a viewer standpoint, it would be fascinating to see Connor and Justin in the finals, because not only would the Ontario Singles Championship be on the line, so would the Tour Championship. Obviously, I want to do everything I can to stop that from happening, but just from a fan's perspective, that would be an interesting tournament result final. With that being said, it'll be interesting to see what happens and to see the final results for this 2023 to 2024 NCAA Tour season. Thank you for joining me on the Pink Shirt Pod. I hope to record and release my next episode in May, which will be a review of this past tour season, as well as a World Crokinole Championship preview. But for now, thanks again to Ron Langell for joining me today. Thanks to my wife, Jen, for creating the thumbnail art for this podcast. And thanks, as always, to Grant Flick for the music entitled Crokinole that he composed and performed. Until next time, keep on flicking.